Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about oncology in general, what it takes to become a medical oncologist, how we treat patients, and what are the different aims of therapeutics, and then we'll talk a little bit about how we develop therapeutics for patients through the different phases of clinical trials. I provided a clinical trial publication for all of you to review. Did you all get it? Okay. So there will be no exam questions about selinexor, okay? The reason I gave you this phase one clinical trial is because I think it exemplifies a lot of the things that we do in medical oncology when we're treating patients who have relapsed and refractory disease, where we're trying newly identified compounds. So selinexor is interesting because it's an absolutely new target, right? It has a mechanism of action that we think we understand. They tested it in a dose escalation study, and so they looked at a variety of different doses. And so the clinical trial gives you the exposure to that clinical trial, that if you review it, gives you the exposure of the different things that are done during the testing of a novel drug for the first time in humans. So I thought it was worthwhile to take a look at that clinical trial. Did anybody have any questions about the paper? I'll take it by the deep silence that that's no. Okay. All right. So oncology is the study of malignant tumors of lethal potential. I think this is an important point because there are many tumors that occur, right? Fatty tumors, for example, that are non-lethal, and these are not considered in the practice of oncology. Malignancies can arise in any tissue at any age and spread by either direct extension to the local tissues within the area or lymphatic or vascular circulation. Cancer is currently the second leading cause of death in the U.S. It accounts for a quarter of U.S. deaths and the third leading cause of death worldwide after heart disease and infection. I'm sure you've seen this slide a million times in different presentations. This is only to emphasize that the most common types of cancer in humans are cancer of the breast and cancer of the breast and prostate in men and women, respectively, followed by the lung and bronchus, colon and rectum, and uterus in women, and then bladder, melanoma, non-Hodgkin lymphoma. My personal area of expertise is in acute myeloid leukemia, myelodysplastic syndrome, and other heme malignancies. And as you can see, it's a relatively rare disorder. And if we look at AML, that's a much lower level. So what causes cancer? I think globally, the most common cause of cancer is actually viral or infectious mechanisms. Okay? Hepatitis B, HPV, or human papillomavirus, Epstein-Barr virus, which is associated with lymphoma diagnoses, and HIV, have a strong association with malignancy and a strong risk of transformation to malignancy. Additionally, things like H. pylori cause upper GI cancers and account for the substantial increase in incidence of gastric cancers and cancers of the upper GI tract in places like Asia, where H. pylori is very prominent. We increasingly recognize genetic predisposition as being a very important cause of malignancy. So historically, right, we said that in acute leukemia, most people who get leukemia, we thought that that was mostly as a result of bad luck or chemotherapy exposure. We're increasingly recognizing that there are germline predisposition syndromes that can actually put people at increased risk for these. We see these germline predisposition syndromes associated with a wide spectrum of different malignancies, including heme malignancy and malignancies of solid tumors. So genetics are an increasingly recognized cause. And it's not always the case that genetic predisposition syndromes present in young people. It actually turns out that some of these genetic predispositions show up in later life, with median age in the 60s and 70s. We know that chemical carcinogens are a substantial cause of malignancy. So tobacco, benzene exposure, Agent Orange, all of these are associated. Environmental and industrial carcinogens are also important. That's partly why we have such a high incidence of cancer here in Western New York, and indeed around the Great Lakes, where there's a high incidence of industrial carcinogen exposure. We also know that particular chemotherapeutics are associated with malignancy and malignant transformation, and we know that radiation exposure is a source of malignant transformation, particularly people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We see a substantial increase in the incidence of malignancies of the hematologic system, particularly myelodysplasia. So if you look here, this is data regarding the incidence of hepatitis B and hepatocellular carcinoma. Hepatitis B is one of the major hepatitis that occur worldwide. Still worldwide, hepatitis B is the leading cause of hepatocellular cancer. The presence of hepatitis B at high-level copy numbers, so the active hepatitis B, is strongly associated with the substantial risk of developing a hepatocellular carcinoma. In this country, we have a relatively higher, lower level of hepatitis B, because in fact, a majority of you guys are probably vaccinated when you were babies, right? And now all kids, when they go to university, they have to be vaccinated with the hepatitis B series. You remember those ones you got before, either before you went to university or when you were in, depending on how old you are, or when you were a baby. And we do this because hepatitis B is extraordinarily contagious, and by treating with a vaccine, we have a very high level of protection. We have no current vaccines for hepatitis C, although these days we have excellent drugs to treat hepatitis C, and the combination of hepatitis C or hepatitis C with alcohol substantially increases the risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. So here you can see data about H. pylori. I mentioned before that the incidence of H. pylori is substantially higher in Asian populations. You can see here that H. pylori positivity strongly associates with the presence of gastric cancer. So when you treat H. pylori, which is an upper GI bacteria, right? It's a curved bacteria that lives in the upper GI tract, historically associated with high incidence of ulcerative disease of the upper GI tract. That in fact, if you treat H. pylori people and make them H. pylori negative, you decrease substantially the risk of gastric cancer. This is a slide just to point to genetic susceptibilities, and you can see here the cancer rate per 100,000 of population. You can see a substantially high rate of malignancies in an African American population here compared with white population, African American women and white women. Some of this points to genetic susceptibility. Other of this actually points to exposures, right? One could argue that white women historically have been relatively less in the workforce, relatively less exposed potentially to environmental pathogens associated with working. Perhaps slightly African American women have been slightly less exposed than their counterparts, African American men, and white men, perhaps more white collar work and less exposure. We definitely know that mutations in the germline, like BRCA1 and 2, as well as the Lynch syndrome mutations and P53 mutations, can confer a substantial risk of cancers at a variety of different organ systems. Here you can see breast cancer by age 50, the incidence here in those BRCA negative and those BRCA positive, right? So substantially higher rate in BRCA positive compared to BRCA negative patients. Breast cancer risk by age 70, 87% of BRCA carriers will have a cancer by the age of 70, whereas 8% of women in the general population. And a second breast cancer by age 70, up to 64% of carriers of BRCA versus 11% of all women in general who do not have BRCA mutations. Again, we increasingly recognize that additional mutational events in the germline can confer enhanced susceptibility. And with deep sequencing and deep genomic sequencing, we can identify some of these mutations. We know that exposures, personal choice exposures, for example, things like smoking, as well as alcohol, can enhance substantially the risk of cancer. Lung cancer is the most notable of these, right? So you can see here cigarette consumption in men, and lung cancer in men. This is an exposure that has a relatively long window of exposure and then a relatively long latency before you see the cancer emerge, right? So you see a substantial difference, but these curves really pretty much overlay one another. And the cigarette consumption in women started later historically than it did in men because it was viewed as a male predisposition. And so the incidence of lung cancer in women, the rate of lung cancer occurs later. So the peak in lung cancer death occurs later. You can see here worldwide smoking prevalence in men versus women. We did a very interesting experiment using the Women's Health Initiative in which we started supplementing women with estrogen. Women frequently develop postmenopausal symptoms, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, dry skin, dry, brittle hair. And so there was a period of time when doctors would supplement women with estrogen. Initially, this was both unopposed estrogen, so single estrogen, and then it was combination estrogen and progesterone. This is an example of patients with breast cancer particularly, but you can also look at the incidence of uterine cancers. And what they found is, in fact, that in women who were receiving estrogen supplementation, there was a substantial increase in the rate of estrogen receptor positive tumors. And that after you discontinued estrogen exposure, so after we decided that we were no longer going to supplement women with estrogen, that the incidence of estrogen receptor positive tumors fell off. Okay? So demonstrating that estrogen is potentially carcinogenic for the breast in postmenopausal women. It turns out that unopposed estrogen is also predisposes to the development of uterine cancer. And so historically, women would receive estrogen supplementation to deal with the symptoms of menopause. And there was a substantial increase in the rate of uterine cancers in that context. If you add progesterone, it turns out that you do not increase the risk of uterine cancer. We know that sun exposure increases the risk of cancer, so we can see that places where they get a substantial amount of sun compared with places like, for example, Buffalo, have a lower rate of melanoma cancer. And you can see here the risk of melanoma in Australia versus the United States, where in Australia we have substantially more sun exposure than in the U.S., whereas stomach cancer rates are about the same. This is a not sun exposed related cancer. And here we see H. pylori. We also know that treatments for malignancy can increase the risk of secondary cancers. So here you can see patients receiving radiation and alkylators for treatment of breast cancer, relatively young, can develop secondary malignancies, in this case, either alkylator agent-related AMLs or topoisomerase-related AMLs. So it turns out that radiation exposure results in an increased incidence of complex karyotype late events that occur with a latency of between 10 and 15 years. If you expose people to topoisomerase inhibitors, do you guys all know what topoisomerase does? Okay, which poisons the unwinding ability of the genome, that you increase the incidence of a specific type of secondary leukemia called the 11q23 type leukemia, or the MLL-rearranged leukemia. And this is felt to risk, and this is usually with a relatively short latency period between 2 and 3 years. And you can see this here in the graph on the right. You can see the incidence of AML in patients following the diagnosis of Hodgkin's disease. And for Hodgkin's disease, they receive a combination of radiation and alkylator-based therapy. All right, so now we've described some of the risks and approaches that result in malignancy. I think that the one thing that I did not mention here, but that I think is extraordinarily important, is the fact that malignancy is actually substantially increased with aging, right? And so as the population in general ages, we see a substantial increase in the rates of malignancy, largely as a result of the fact that that over the course of your exposure, over the course of your life, the stem cell compartment in your body gets exposed to the whole of what you get exposed to, and there's an increased risk that one of those stem cells can develop a mutation that then results in a malignancy. So age, more than any other thing, age itself represents a substantial risk factor for malignancy. So how do we avoid cancer? Right? Cancer has become this sort of specter that lives above us, that we think about a lot, that patients worry about, and because of excellent marketing back in the 1950s and 60s, we developed this war on cancer, and cancer became a single monolithic entity. In fact, cancer is a very broad spectrum of different things, some of which we can potentially prevent, right? So primary prevention is one way to avoid getting cancer. And the things you can do to avoid cancer with primary prevention are things like avoid tobacco, avoid alcohol, avoid dietary exposures that increase the risk of cancer. We know that charred meats contain chemicals that increase the risk of malignancy, so charred meat, for example. Environmental exposure management, so make sure you try to avoid places where there's been a huge amount of environmental toxin. Vaccination against HPV has been a substantial thing that has occurred in the last 10 to 15 years, and we hope that by vaccinating against HPV, we'll decrease the rates of upper aerodigestive tract cancers as well as the rates of cervical cancer in women. And antibiotics to treat H. pylori, for example, and to treat hepatitis. The second thing we can do is to try and find the cancer early before it causes trouble and see if we can get rid of it. So this is so-called screening, early screening. So that means a cancer in which early detection and removal can prevent the cancer from spreading and causing trouble. And so this is really effective for cancers where the cancer starts in a single location. You can remove the cancer and then you can treat the patient essentially preventively and you never have a problem. So one might argue that breast cancer detection is one such event. So early detection of breast cancer using mammography can identify early stage breast cancers, and patients can have that breast cancer resected and receive no other therapy and be potentially cured. PSA testing is designed to detect prostate cancer early, and one could argue about whether or not PSA and digital rectal examination are effective and prevent substantially long-term sequelae from prostate cancer. But certainly for some patients, particularly young patients, particularly those with BRCA mutations or particularly those with high-risk family history, early detection and removal of the prostate seems to decrease the likelihood that you'll get metastatic prostate cancer and die of it. Pap smears are a great example of preventive, of screening prevention. So women these days, if they've been sexually active, receive pap smears. and they receive pap smears at a minimum once every 3 years. Those with higher risk behaviors or those with an underlying immunodeficiency syndrome, for example, like HIV, should receive more frequent pap smears because there is an interplay between those two infections and the decreased immunity. And so pap smears can identify early malignant transformation lesions and remove those early malignant transformation lesions and prevent the development of true cancer or invasive cancer. Colonoscopy, another excellent way of preventing disease. You have early polyps that develop. You do a colonoscopy, you can remove the polyp, and you can prevent the patient from getting a true invasive malignancy. These are effective screening treatments. So that's sort of before the cat gets out of the bag, but once the cat gets out of the bag, the question is how do you fix it? So for treatment, we have surgery. Now, anytime you're talking about surgery or radiation, I want you to think local control, okay? So surgery and radiation provide local control of the malignancy, and if the malignancy is something that is in a single location, and you can cut it out or radiate it, and when you think about radiation, I want you to think local only, right? Radiation doesn't do anything for the rest of the body. Those approaches help to identify cancer within the spectrum of the radiation portal or within the place where you cut it out and remove the primary cancer. Versus systemic chemotherapy with things like oncology therapy, which includes cytotoxic therapies, hormonal therapies, immunologic therapies, targeted and supportive therapies. And then the last thing that's on here, but probably should be one of the first, is actually palliation of symptoms. Because unlike house, the reality is that many people, when they have advanced malignancy, are going to die of their malignancy. And so we don't want people to be suffering while they're getting treated and with their disease. So medical oncology is what I do. A medical oncologist is a doctor who specializes in diagnosing and treating cancer using chemotherapy, hormone therapy, or biologic therapy. There are surgeons who are surgical oncologists who specialize in removing cancers, but that's actually a different specialty. We are often the main healthcare providers for patients with cancer, and we also provide supportive care and coordinate treatments with other specialties. And what I can tell you is mostly when somebody gets a malignant diagnosis, all the other physicians within the patient's experience give up therapeutic responsibility and they feed responsibility to us. So we become the primary doctor for those patients. So how do you become a medical oncologist? You go to undergraduate, then you do medical school, 4 to 8 years, then you do, depending on whether or not you decide to do a PhD. Then you do internal medicine residency, which lasts about 3 years in general, and then you do a hematologic an oncology plus or minus a hematology fellowship. Those are two separate specializations. And that takes between 3 and 5 years. I've had some friends who took a little longer, but you know, those are recalcitrant people. And then you make a decision about whether you want to go into private practice, where you see patients on a fee-for-service basis in the community, whether you want to do academics, or whether you want to consider doing a job in industry. In terms of our role in cancer prevention, unfortunately, it's really not that much. By the time patients see me, they have to have a diagnosis of malignancy. Our role is to educate the population and educate people like you and people like internal medicine doctors about identifying patients and about looking for things that make them suspicious of malignancy. We're responsible for social and occupational as well as education about nutritional and sexual practices that contribute to neoplasia. We can educate sometimes the general public. One of the things that I do a lot with my patients, and again, you could argue that the cat's already out of the bag with my patients, but I often talk to them about discontinuation of smoking. Smoking is the number one preventable thing that we can do to prevent cancer, and since the time I was very small, I've been troubling people all my life about stopping smoking. Additionally, vaccination, things like HPV vaccination, HPV vaccination and HIV prevention are significant things that increase the risk of cancer. And then appropriate screening, as we discussed. So a cancer diagnosis requires histologic proof on at least one occasion of the presence of malignant cells. I put this here because, in fact, I have a family friend who presented with abdominal pain and distension and who went into her local doctor, was found to have ascites, or fluid in her belly. And the fluid looked very suspicious. So she had a CAT scan. The CAT scan showed what was described as caking or encrusting of the omentum, which is an organ in the stomach, with something that looked for all the world like malignancy. She had a needle inserted into her belly, and some of the fluid was drained out. And the fluid, they couldn't see any malignant cells there. But clinically, the picture on the scan was extraordinarily suspicious. It was so suspicious that they referred her for treatment with chemotherapy, and in fact they put a port in her chest to start the chemotherapy. And just because she happened to know me, and because she's a woman who said, well, I just don't believe it, it's not true, she called me. She said, look, I just don't believe it. What's going on? I just don't think I have cancer. I can't believe it. I'm totally beyond me. So I called her oncologist. The oncologist and I spoke on the phone. She went for a second opinion. Second opinion doctor said, this scan, it's for sure cancer. There's nothing else this could possibly be. It's absolutely cancer. There's no reason to do a surgery on her. We can't see the cells, but I'm sure it's cancer. It looks like cancer. There's no question. This is how ovarian cancer looks. And I said, look, I appreciate that, but she's never, ever going to take chemotherapy unless she has cancer cells in the dish. I'm sorry, but this is the correct. This is the answer. Can we not do surgery first, debulking surgery, and then do the chemotherapy afterwards? And we'll talk about the different types of, the ways of giving surgery versus chemotherapy and what we call those. So she went to the operating room, and in fact, she had a surgery, and when they did that, they found that she had something called endometriosis, which is in fact a benign accumulation of endometrial glands on the inside of the abdomen, and it's not a malignant condition. So I think it's extraordinarily important, if you ever know somebody or if you're dealing with somebody who has cancer, you want to see the cells. Okay? We have a thing in oncology training, we say tissue is the issue, right? I need to see those cells. I need to see that there's cancer there. And until I see the cells for sure, until I absolutely see those cells, I do not believe it. I think by the same token, when you have a patient who has an underlying history of cancer diagnosis, be suspicious that the cancer is back. Any symptoms in a patient who has previously had a history of cancer, even if the cancer diagnosis was 10 or 15 years ago, be suspicious that the cancer is back. Always don't trust the cancer. Be afraid of the cancer. You should never attribute symptoms to the cancer without a biopsy, but you should always conclude the cancer on the differential of the cause. Cancer patients, though, can have other symptomatic diseases, and those should also be treated appropriately. So what is chemotherapy? Over the next several weeks to months, you guys are going to get a ton of lectures about different types of cancer specifically and the different treatments that we use, and we call all of them chemotherapy. This is a generic term, which historically meant genotoxins, right? Historically meant DNA interrupting agents, but now it's really referred to more targeted therapies as well. So BCR-ABL inhibitors like imatinib, dasatinib, nilotinib, all of these are tyrosine kinase inhibitors, right? They hit mutations that are present in the cancer itself. They do not cause genotoxic stress, they don't cause cell death in the traditional way, but those are still considered chemotherapy agents. An oncologist is generally responsible for choosing the appropriate drug and dose combination for patients, and the drugs depend on the cancer type, the stage, the patient age, and the comorbidities that are present. Our job is also to manage side effects of these agents. So the principles of treatment include identifying the place of the tumor. So where did the tumor arise, and what effect does it have on normal organ structure and function? How toxic is the treatment to surrounding tissues and to normal tissues? And what is the aim of the treatment? Is it curative treatment? Because if it's curative treatment, I'm willing to tolerate a lot more toxicity, right? For short-term curative therapy than I will if it's palliative therapy, right? So a lot of the time, what we're doing is actually treating patients whose death is very likely to be caused by the malignancy that they have. And no matter what we do, they're still going to die of their cancer. So in that case, it's a lot harder to tolerate substantial toxicity, unless you're going to buy a substantial period of time. So in terms of thinking about cancer therapeutics, you want to think about, first thing, you don't want to do any harm. Primum non nocere is an old thing it's an old thing from the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. You want to continuously reassess whether or not the therapeutics that you're offering are causing more harm than good. Sorry, I'm on call. So if the patient is not deriving clinical benefits from the treatment you're offering, then consider stopping it. I think another thing that's very important, if you don't know what to do, don't do anything. Sit back, converse with your colleagues, ask another person, get another opinion, look again, do another biopsy. And the treatment really shouldn't be worse than the disease, especially if the therapy that you're offering is not curative. So in terms of therapeutic approaches with chemotherapy, we have local regional approaches, as I said before. Surgery and radiation in large measure are really local approaches, right? So if cancer is in a specific location, then you can treat with those localized therapies. Now, sometimes patients will have malignancy in a specific location as well as in other locations. So one example of this is when patients have brain metastatic disease. So patients with lung cancer will sometimes develop all of a sudden symptoms of headache or what have you, or nausea or vomiting, and you'll find that they have a metastatic lesion in the brain. Now the brain is a box that has a limited amount of space around it, and if you put an extra cancer thing in there, it takes up extra space and it pushes on the important things that are supposed to be up there, right? And most of the chemotherapeutics that we use do not cross the blood-brain barrier effectively. So the chemos that we give intravenously don't really work that well there. So there are some cases in which where you have a lesion which is pressing aggressively on a particular area and you need to treat it quickly. In some cases, you will use radiation, which will not treat the rest of the disease in the patient, to treat that specific lesion in the brain. Okay? And the idea there is that you're going to palliate the symptoms and get rid of the tumors that are growing in that specific location, because the chemotherapies you're going to give systemically are not going to get in there. There are some cancers where the rates of malignant infiltration of the cerebrospinal fluid and of the brain are so high that you give prophylactic radiation to the brain as a way of treating. Right? So this is true for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, where we sometimes give radiation exposure to the brain preventively. And for things like small cell lung cancer, where if you have localized small cell lung cancer, you can potentially cure it by giving chemotherapy and radiation. But if you don't treat the brain, that can be a source of systemic relapse later on. So we give prophylactic cranial radiation for treatment of those cases. So chemotherapy can sometimes be given locally. So things like intravesicular chemotherapy, you can instill chemotherapy into the bladder. You can give intrathecal chemotherapy. So we very frequently for leukemia will give chemotherapy inside the cerebrospinal fluid through a spinal tap. You can give topical chemotherapy for some skin cancers. And for patients who have malignancy that has gone to the liver, either primary liver cancer or colon cancer with liver metastases, you can either resect the liver metastatic lesion. And some patients, you can actually cure them by doing that, by giving systemic chemotherapy to treat the localized disease in the GI tract and then resecting the metastatic lesion in the liver. Or you can give hepatic artery chemoembolization, where you stick a catheter into the person's leg, you go up into the liver itself, and you specifically occlude the blood vessel that goes to the mets. And then we have systemic chemotherapies, which are given to the whole person and which are supposed to go to all parts of the body. Most chemotherapies that are given systemically include things like cytotoxic chemotherapies, hormonal therapies like anti-estrogens that you take orally, immunologic therapies like the new checkpoint inhibitors that are all over the news, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and supportive cares, which we give to everyone, antiemetics, growth factors, and narcotics for control of pain. So very frequently in oncology, we actually combine therapies. We call this neoadjuvant chemotherapy. You give the chemotherapy first, and then you plan to do surgery later. So sometimes, if you have patients who have breast cancer or colon cancer, and the colon cancer or breast cancer or pancreas cancer is a little bit big, you give chemotherapy first with the idea of maybe shrinking the tumor back a little bit so you can do a more effective surgery. And if the cancer shrinks back, you can get really good negative margins and you can potentially create a curative surgical approach that's been supplemented by the chemotherapy. One can also use this approach to identify chemotherapy sensitivity. So for people who have sarcomas, especially children with sarcomas, you give neoadjuvant chemotherapy and then you do the surgery to assess how much of the cancer has died. And that predicts longevity, relapse rates, and likelihood of doing well with therapy. Sometimes you can also enhance the efficacy of radiation. So some people who have digestive tract tumors, for example, tumors that used to involve tumors involving the larynx or the small and important machinery of the voice box. Historically, patients needed to complete resection of those tissues, and then they were left with no voice. And in the last 20 years, we've identified that if you combine chemotherapy and radiation, chemotherapy thereby sensitizes the cancers that are locally there to the radiation-induced killing, you can avoid removal of those important structures and preserve the voice box, preserve speech. Okay, so sometimes we use combinations of neoadjuvant chemo and radiation to avoid removing important structures that preserve quality of life. Outcomes are the same with surgical resection and with combined modality chemo radiation for upper respiratory, upper aerodigestive tract tumors, but with substantial improvements in quality of life. And so that's something you would choose, right? Every single day, we would all choose to have our larynx, I think. Right? You agree? You could nod. This is something we can all agree on, yeah? Certainly, I would agree, because I like to talk. Okay, so adjuvant therapy means therapy that's given after the surgery. So you have a surgical procedure. For example, you have a breast cancer. You have an early-stage breast cancer. The surgeon takes you to the operating room. They do a needle localization where they stick a needle inside of the tumor. They resect the primary tumor. And then they do usually what they call a sentinel lymph node study, where they inject a dye into the tumor or they inject radionuclide into the tumor. And then they follow that into the axilla, into the armpit, which is the draining lymph node basin for the tumor. And then they assess how many of those first draining lymph nodes contain cancer. And depending on whether or not those lymph nodes contain overt cancer or molecular evidence of cancer using things like the Oncotype DX, we then decide whether or not the patient needs more or less chemotherapy or additional radiation, right? It used to be that everybody got a complete resection of the breast, right? These days we do needle localization and lumpectomy, followed by whole breast radiotherapy, plus or minus radiation involving the axilla, or the upper nodes and the upper chest, and then we go on with additional chemotherapy, right, to see if we can get rid of those malignancies. So adjuvant chemotherapy is given after the surgery. For some tumors, this kind of approach can offer cure, so things like Wilms' tumor and osteosarcoma. For others, it can prolong the disease-free interval. This is true for stage 2 or 3 breast cancer and stage 3 ovarian cancer. So in ovarian cancer, you can do surgical resection, massive surgical, as much of resection as you can, and then you can give chemotherapy after the fact, and this prolongs the period of time between when the surgery is and when the cancer comes back. And for some patients, you can have a very prolonged disease-free interval. So targeted therapies, in this day and age, we have a lot of targeted therapies. You certainly hear about them on the news and on the radio. Targeted therapies are medications which block growth of cancer cells specifically by interfering with molecular targets needed for carcinogenesis, growth, or metastases, rather than by using genotoxic stress, which is the traditional way of giving chemotherapy. These cell therapies are usually more effective and potentially less harmful to normal cells, and this provides a new paradigm, right? So trial design and stability versus remission. This approach applies to things like monoclonal antibodies, things like rituximab and Herceptin, as well as tyrosine kinase inhibitors and some vaccine strategies. So upfront chemotherapy is used for diseases which are not treatable with local measures, and for most solid tumors, the goal is usually prolongation of survival rather than cure. These are systemically administered drugs, so for patients with metastatic lung cancer, for patients with metastatic breast cancer, upfront chemotherapies are used to shrink the tumors, to prevent those tumors from pressing on important organs, and to prolong survival, but they are generally not curative. That being said, there are a small subset of cancers which are curable with systemic chemotherapy. These include particular types of lymphoblastic leukemia and lymphoma, particularly those in children, although some in adults as well. Cancers of testis, like seminomas particularly. You probably all know about Lance Armstrong, who was a hero for many years in the cancer community, and now it's taken a little bit of a hit as a result of his doping. But nonetheless, he had widely metastatic seminoma, and he received chemotherapy, which is in fact curative for many patients with metastatic seminoma, and is now in remission for many years. Hodgkin lymphomas, even stage 4 Hodgkin lymphomas, can be effectively treated with chemotherapy and in fact cured. Burkitt lymphomas and leukemias can sometimes be cured. Diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, even presenting at late stage, can be cured with certain chemotherapy combinations. Hairy cell leukemia is a classical disease that presents with low blood counts and which can be cured with a single course of a drug called 2-CDA. And chronic myelogenous leukemia, I saw on this list, although I don't know if I agree that it's completely curable, but chronic myelogenous leukemia is sort of the poster child for targeted therapeutics in cancer. This is the disease which is associated with the BCR-ABL1 translocation involving the P210 breakpoint. And in this cancer, we had the very first of the targeted therapeutics, imatinib methylate or Gleevec, as you may have heard of it. And this drug binds in the ATP binding pocket of the oncogene, the BCR-ABL oncoprotein, and blocks its activation of ABL1 kinase. And you can block all of the sequelae of that abnormality of that fusion gene by giving this small molecule therapeutic, and you can prolong and in fact cure some patients with that approach. So there are some cancers that are curable with combined modality chemoradiation, Most of these are non-metastatic carcinomas, although there are some early-stage lung cancers that can be cured. I spoke briefly about head and neck cancers, for which chemoradiation combination can offer cure. Some early-stage gastric and esophageal cancers can be cured with combined modality chemoradiotherapy. Maybe some breast cancers, maybe some prostate cancers, maybe some ovarian cancers, and maybe sarcomas, some, although it's really best if they're really small. So the rest, most metastatic cancers are not curable. Even cancers that are treated at relatively early stages can have micrometastatic disease, and this is true of breast cancer particularly, which can show up many years later, sometimes 10 or 15 years later. And cancers that relapse are often difficult to treat as a result of the acquisition of additional genes that provide resistance to chemotherapies. So we try a lot of high-dose therapy. We tried autotransplant, in fact, for breast cancer, which is the idea of giving such high dose to chemotherapy that you would, in fact, kill off the bone marrow, and then a rescue bone marrow transplant of your own cells, with the idea that the problem is just that the breast cancer cells were intrinsically resistant to chemotherapy. But unfortunately, this turned out to not be effective at all, and in fact increased substantially the rates of secondary leukemias that patients with breast cancer got. So we don't do that anymore. In breast cancer, they also tested the idea of giving the chemotherapy closer together, with the idea that if you could give chemotherapy right on top, one on top of the other, you might be able to increase the rates of cure. And so for some patients, we give growth factors to improve this. Certainly, this is true to some extent for some types of lymphoma, where dose density makes a difference. And then we try to combine many different drugs to give sequentially or in combination to limit toxicity and avoid resistance. So things that have acronyms like Promace, Cytobom, or CHOP, or Hyper-CDAD. And then we try new drugs and new drug combinations using clinical trials. So in terms of cancer drug development, a lot of what we do in oncology, particularly at tertiary and quaternary referral centers, is to try to test new drugs for patients who failed the standard of care. The first of these processes is something that you may well be part of in the rest of your career, and that's novel compound identification and testing. So this is where you have a small molecule or you have a compound that looks like it might be active, and you test it against a wide variety of different cancer cell lines in a dish, and then you test it using a variety of different well-established algorithms for evaluating response within different cancer types. And then you ask the question, do you see cancer cell death? What's the mechanism of that cancer cell death? Is there anything that we could give in combination with this? And then you move it into animal models, mice first, and then monkeys, and then you move it into patients in phase one clinical trials. The next step is product production and formulation, because it's all very well to have a great drug that kills cancer cells in a dish, but if you can't get that drug to dissolve in water, you are going to have a very substantial hard time getting it into patients. If that drug causes damage to the vascular system, you're not going to be able to give it to a patient. So there are a lot of issues of formulation and of drug development with respect to production of the drug. How difficult is it to make it? The next thing is toxicology. Again, in vivo, in mouse models, mice and then monkeys. And then we bring in patients. So we do phase one clinical trials, then we do phase two clinical trials. Again, the example that I gave you to read was a phase one clinical trial. Phase two clinical trials, phase three clinical trials, and then general medical use or phase four. So I'm going to review this in great detail, but again, I suspect you'll find that the answers on the test are going to be relatively simple. Okay? I usually focus on the different phases of clinical trial development. The point of this is so you understand the general gestalt of how do you get a drug from the bench, from an idea in somebody's mind, to a patient. Okay? So traditionally, cancer chemotherapy through the National Service Center was established by the NCI in 1955, and this was so that you could screen a large variety of different chemical compounds against different cell lines in vitro. The first example of this, and the first drug that was used effectively in cancer, is the drug Taxol, which was extracted from the bark of the Pacific yew tree. This drug was identified based on efficacy, and then the mechanism of its action was interrogated after the fact. Modern drug development is actually based on the idea of rational drug design. So you crystallize a target, you look at its shape, and then you develop a molecule to fit inside the pocket, right? And so that's a very different way of approaching chemotherapeutics than our traditional way, which is we see something, it kills stuff, and then we test to see how it works. So the NCI drug screen preliminarily incubates your compound in vitro with three different types of tumor cell line at a single concentration for 48 hours. Then you look to see if there's any activity there. So if you see any cell kill at all, then you can in vitro screen with 60 different human tumor cell lines at 5 different concentrations for 48 hours. And then if you see promising activity in either a particular subtype of cancer or in all subtypes of cancer, then you do something called a hollow fiber technique, which is where you have cancer cells growing within the context of a hollow fiber, and you run your chemotherapy drug across that, and you see if you can open that up. And then you follow up with in vivo testing using cancer xenografts, either human tumors growing on the back of a skid mouse, and then you treat them with various doses and schedules for an extended period. By contrast with rational drug design, you identify a target. You recognize it as being strongly associated with a malignancy. CML is really easy, right? Nice low-hanging fruit. A single mutational event that 100% penetrance results in the malignancy of issue, right? So if I give a mouse VCR-ADL1 in its bone marrow compartment, that mouse will develop a high white cell count, high platelet count, big spleen, right? Every single time. 100% penetrant. If I give the gene, I get the outcome. So that makes it really nice. It also is a tyrosine kinase, which you can actually inhibit. And using high throughput chemical library screening, they were able to identify a particular molecule that bound to that abnormal oncoprotein, right? They tested that compound, they modified it so that it would be more water soluble. And then they developed the drug imatinib. Okay? Now imatinib actually turns out to be quite a dirty drug. It hits a whole bunch of different tyrosine kinases. Tyrosine kinases are like switches, they exist throughout our genome. They're useful for all sorts of things, right? Platelet-derived growth factor is a tyrosine kinase. KIT is a tyrosine kinase. BCR-ABL is a kinase. ABL is a kinase, right? All of these different kinases. BCR-ABL can be inhibited. What you want is a drug that inhibits BCR-ABL1 more or less specifically. But it's okay if it's a little dirty also. The toxicities that you get from these drugs reflect its relative dirtiness. So I've given a ton of imatinib, and what I can tell you is that every single patient who gets imatinib gets diarrhea. Okay? They get an upset tummy, lots of them get nauseated, they get swelling, they get a little swelling around their eyes, they get a little swelling in their ankles, some of them get a lot of swelling, some of them get pancreatitis, okay? And all of the tyrosine kinases that are in the same family as imatinib, relative to their degree of specificity for BCR-ABL1 versus other tyrosine kinases, will have a similar spectrum of symptoms that are related to the fact that they hit other kinases, right? We then test these drugs in preclinical animal models and against human cell lines, and then you show clinical trials which demonstrate efficacy. So you have to produce the drug, you have to formulate it, and you have to assess toxicology. So drug metabolism turns out to be extraordinarily important. So you give these drugs to patients, and then the liver does a whole bunch of things to them. It adds a whole bunch of glucuronidation to them, it alters their susceptibility. It turns out that a lot of the drugs that we give, the primary metabolite is actually the active component. So it's not the first pass. So if you give the drug just on its own in the dish, it may not work at all. But if you give it to a person or you give it to a mouse, then it will work. And that's because of the activation steps that can occur in vivo. And you wouldn't necessarily know that until you've given it to some animal species. So the chemical formulation is very important. Some drugs are not at all soluble, and so you have to give them intravenously. Some drugs have too much solubility, so they get into sites where you don't want them to go. Some of these drugs are very extensively protein bound. So when we were first developing tyrosine kinase inhibitors for acute myeloid leukemia, we had clear evidence that FLT3 ITD was very important in leukemia. Okay? We saw that in patients who had very high-grade disease, the disease grew quickly, that FLT3 activation was very important. So there was a whole series of studies in which we gave FLT3 inhibitors to patients, and we failed to see the efficacy that we thought we should see. And it turned out that this happened because in many patients, these drugs, they bind to proteins in the circulation. And it's only the free drug that is active. And it turns out with FLT3, you need to hit the target, you need to keep hitting the target, you need to keep it on all the time. And if extensively the drug is protein bound, based on very, very small changes in dosing, you can actually lose target hitting. And so the result is that you can get breakthrough. If you have patients who happen to be heavier, because the amount of plasma protein that you have is based on your total body size. And if you're giving a single flat dose, the effective level of drug in circulation might be quite variable. So this is important to recognize the differences that you get with dose, frequency, and route, and this is why we do pharmacokinetic analyses. and then toxicology in at least two animal species, and then large scale. You have to have a large scale production plan. So before you start thinking about giving these drugs to patients, you have to have a plan in place to make enough to do your clinical trial. You wouldn't believe how difficult this is. In fact, we frequently have this case. I'm asking a company for drugs for a clinical trial, and they say, well, look, I can't even entertain the idea of giving you any investigator-initiated clinical trial drug because I don't have enough to run my phase 3 clinical trial. I'm barely making it, right? So what's going to happen when they start making this real time, right? When they start using it for real things, this is an issue. So in order to get a drug into a patient, you need to file something called an investigational new drug application. This is required for new drugs, but also for old drugs that are being used in a different way, for new drug combinations. And you can do an individual or a single patient investigational new drug application for patients who are receiving drugs with a compassionate access. So drugs that are not yet approved by the FDA, but you want to give it to a patient based on preclinical or evidence of early efficacy in early phase clinical trials. So there are three types of investigational new drug applications. The investigator submitted IND, which is submitted for a single physician doing an investigator-initiated clinical trial. This IND proposes studying an unapproved drug or an approved drug for a new indication or a new patient population. There's an emergency use IND, which is where I say I have a patient who has a disease, I have a drug that I think is going to be efficacious for that patient, they have no other options, and I want to get access to that drug for this patient because I think that there might be some clinical activity. And that's an emergency use IND. And then there's a treatment IND, which is submitted for experimental drugs showing promise in clinical testing for that. So these INDs can be submitted by either a commercial or a research entity. The application has to contain information about three broad areas, so animal pharmacology and toxicology studies, which establish safety for initial testing in humans. They have to include previous experience with the drug in humans, if there is any. They have to include manufacturing information, so they have to reassure us that they know how to make the drug, that it's consistent across batches, that the drug is stable, and they have to show that they're going to be able to make enough of it to provide the clinical trial they're proposing. They have to provide a clinical protocol for how to do the study and how to look at the drug, and that includes a detailed protocol for the proposed clinical studies to assess safety and risk, information on the qualifications of the investigators who are going to do the study, and commitment to obtain informed consent from all the subjects who are participating. Once the IND is submitted, the sponsor has to wait 30 days before they do anything, and basically the FDA has 30 days to say, oops, this is a problem, you can't do this. If they don't say anything, you get the go-ahead. So clinical protocols can be designed by independent investigators or pharmaceutical companies. They are also often designed by multi-center cooperative groups. The cooperative groups can include general hospitals and cancer centers based on specific expertise areas or patient populations, and they can, or a variety of different cancer types. So the idea of a clinical protocol is that it's sort of a recipe, just like the recipe in your cookbook, for how to give the drug, how to manage the toxicities from the drug, how to escalate the drug dose, and how to determine when patients are responding or not responding to the drug. The idea of a clinical protocol is that it can be open to any specific institution and that there should be able to be reproducibility with the results of the testing from one institution to the next and from one group of investigators to the next. This helps to avoid omissions and stipulates times for specific procedures, ensures that standard doses of supportive care drugs are also given, and ensure standard endpoints. Anybody who's participating in clinical trials should have access to the written protocol document and should be trained on how to give and use the document. And this includes people like pharmacists and oncology nurses who additionally check on the system, and they're part of this group. So we actually, here at Roswell, we have an investigational drug service. So it's a pharmacy that specializes in giving and making drugs for investigational protocols. We have an investigational drug administration wing. So 7 North is where we send all of our patients who are on clinical trials to get the chemotherapy drugs that are part of their clinical trial. And this ensures that these patients are receiving specialized nursing treatment, that they're receiving specialized pharmacy treatment, and that there's uniformity about the way we do things. So one needn't memorize this page. It's very long, but essentially this covers the essential elements in a protocol. You have to have a cover sheet which says who's the PI on the protocol and who's the study nurse and how do you contact them. You have to have a schema, so sort of an overview of how to use the protocol and what's involved in the protocol. You have to have background and rationale for the protocol, so it tells you why you're doing it, what was your thinking behind it, and what are the objectives of the study. So at the beginning, you have to say, this is what I hope to learn from doing this assessment. Just like you do a bench research experiment, you start out with a hypothesis, and then you test the hypothesis. You have to show which patients you're going to choose. So you want to say, I want a specific group of patients with a specific disease at a specific stage. You have to have a treatment plan with plans for dose adjustments. You have to have information about whether or not all the patients are going to be treated the same way or if they're going to be randomized, and then what they're going to be randomized to and how you're going to stratify that randomization. You have to have any information that's required at baseline. You have to have information about the expected toxicity and how to manage those toxicities, and then criteria for evaluation of response and when to take people off. You have to have information about all the drugs that are being used, how they're available, where they're coming from, how they should be prepared, how they should be given. You have to have information about how to capture adverse events and reactions and any ancillary therapy that should be given on the study. You have to include information about a statistical plan, so how many patients are you going to enroll and why do you need that many patients? What's the justification for that result? If you expect to have a 50% response rate, how many patients do you need? And that's we have to have a statistician who helps with that. You include references, and then you have to include in a model consent form. So phase one trials go from toxicology studies, which occur in animals, to the first in-human study. Patients are often refractory, relapsed, or pretreated, and sometimes they can be many different cancer types. This is sort of a historical thing. These days, in fact, especially with targeted therapeutics, we actually choose a much narrower spectrum of patients, and in fact, we offer some of these treatments up front. Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Sure. Can you text me the number? Can you just give me a call back for a second? Or can I'm giving a lecture. I'm in the middle of giving a lecture. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So the goal of a phase one trial, and this is an important piece of information, the goal of a phase one trial is identification of toxicity. Okay, so you want to make sure the stated goal, if you read a statistical textbook for a phase one study, is identification of toxicity. You want to make sure that the drug is tolerable. There shouldn't, in a phase one trial, be any assessment of efficacy. Now, this is actually not the case anymore in phase one trials. The majority of phase one trials, if they don't show any evidence of efficacy, are actually going to be shut down. But historically, a phase one trial was designed purely to look at toxicity. You're supposed to identify the maximum tolerated dose or the biologically effective dose, which is the new kind of terminology where you're identifying that if you know a target and you want to hit the target. You usually start the dose and the drug at 10% of the lethal dose, 50 in the most sensitive non-human animal species. This is a little bit problematic, especially if you have very targeted therapeutics where the lethal dose 50 is very high, right? So where the drug is actually very, very well tolerated. In that case, you usually will start at a dose where you think you might have some clinical efficacy or 50% of that, and then titrate up. So patients are usually treated in cohorts of 3 to 6 people. So you start by treating 3 people at a time. If you see 0 or 1 toxicity, you expand that cohort to a second group of 3 people. This is so-called classic 3+3 design. After 6 people have been treated and you see no dose-limiting toxicity, you dose escalate to the next level. Then you enroll another 3 patients, right? And if you see no toxicity, you enroll another 3 patients, and then you call that second cohort of 6, or cohort of 6, and then you go up. There are modern trial designs that are a little bit more rapid in terms of dose escalation, where you enroll 3 patients. If you see no toxicity, you can enroll another 3 patients at the next highest dose level. This is particularly true for targeted therapeutics, where you can do a sort of a more rapid dose escalation. Historically, dose escalation was done using a modified Fibonacci sequence, where you have an initial dose escalation of 100%, then 67%, then 50%, then 40%, then 33%, as you get into more likely to be toxic doses. As I said before, in theory, lack of response in a phase one should not kill the drug, but in actual practice these days, with the difficulty and the expense of running clinical trials, in fact, if you don't see a good response, many drugs are stalled in the phase one setting. Many drug companies now, if they have specific drugs that are being developed for a specific indication, they actually will do a combined phase one and phase two study. We currently have a clinical trial that's open here at Roswell Park, which is designed to target mutations called splicing mutations, which you may or may not have heard. This is a new targeted therapeutic where you have, it turns out that in MDS you see frequently these mutations in splicing factors, which results in abnormal splicing. And if you have abnormal splicing, there's expectation that you're going to have substantial synthetic lethality with a splicing inhibitor, because you depend on the function of the normal copy of the splicing gene. So in that study, instead of a classical phase one, they're going to do the first cohort, and if they see no toxicity, then they will, and they see some efficacy, they plan to expand, and they're actually going to do an expansion cohort at each dose level where they see any activity in the single first six patients. So they're actually going to expand for 12 patients. So this way, you can get an expansion cohort of a much larger number of patients, and you can get preliminary evidence about efficacy. And so the first group of three or six patients that they have, those patients don't require a splicing factor mutation because all they're looking for is toxicity. But in the expansion cohort, they require the presence of the mutation, right? So this is one way of getting over the requirements for phase one to not necessarily have activity. It's especially interesting in things where you have a drug where you think there's activity. So this is the kind of thing like a phase 1b trial, which includes these expansion cohorts. This also allows you to investigate pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics at the recommended phase 2 dose, and it allows you for some patients with solid tumors to do biopsies and add complexity for implementation. You can further evaluate tolerability at selected doses and efficacy within a specific tumor type. So often in phase 1 trials, you'll have a phase 1 study that includes all subtypes of cancer, and then because they think they're going to have particular efficacy within a particular subtype, for example, lung cancer or breast cancer, then they will say we're going to do expansion cohort of that within that cancer type. So in a phase 2 trial, the endpoint is response within a specific type of tumor at a specific stage of tumor development. Candidates should not be heavily pretreated. And if you don't see any response at all in a cohort of at least 14 patients, that sort of suggests the drug is not effective. If you see more than one response, then the trial is usually expanded up to 30 patients. And if you see at least 20% response rate, then you think that there might be clinical utility. Unfortunately, effective drugs can be falsely rejected for a variety of different reasons, including, for example, the FLT3 example I showed you before, where we had an effective drug with an effective target, but we had ineffective therapy because we didn't hit the target appropriately. And that's where pharmacokinetics really help you, right? Because it turned out Mark Levis, who's a colleague of mine from Hopkins, did this great experiment where he had a model FLT3 enzyme that he fixed on a dish, and then he took patient serum from the person, and he incubated the patient serum in the dish with that model. And what he could show is if there was adequate free drug in the patient's serum, with the amount of protein that patient had, you could show inhibition of that FLT3, right? And if you had a patient who had too much protein-bound drug, you couldn't get inhibition of that, right? So that's using the patient's serum itself, and that was a sort of an in vivo way of testing how good was the free drug level that you got. But there's, in fact, no other way to test that. So phase 3 trials are designed to test activity and toxicity relative to the current standard of care. So if you have a drug that is already established as a standard of care, which has a certain benchmark efficacy, and then you have a new drug which you think is going to be substantially better. The best example of this is imatinib, right? Imatinib was tested compared with interferon, okay? So historically, interferon was given to patients with CML, resulting in about a 30% response rate, 30 to 50% response rate. Some of those patients would achieve molecular response and they would go into remission. They started with imatinib. They gave patients randomized 1-to-1, okay? Imatinib versus interferon. They treated about 300 patients in this fashion, and they showed that 93% of the patients who got imatinib first line would achieve complete cytogenetic remission, molecular remission, and they would still be on the drug 15 years later, compared with interferon. And the initial study included patients up to a period of, I think they did 6 months of therapy. And then based on the extraordinary efficacy that they showed, they actually closed the study and they did an expansion, and all those patients who received interferon were able to cross over. The size of the trial is based on the expected difference in response rate between the new treatment and the old treatment. Some studies are actually done to demonstrate equivalence. And if you're trying to demonstrate equivalence, you actually need quite a large number of patients because you want to make sure that there's no substantial difference. So that calculation is called the power calculation. This is an important piece of information for the test. The power calculation is a way to figure out how many patients are needed to demonstrate the difference in outcome that you expect from your phase 3 study. Okay? If a new treatment has a response rate of 60% and a standard of care has a response rate of 40%, to have a 90% chance of seeing differences with statistically significant, you need 139 patients in each arm. And this is a so-called power calculation. And there are computer programs that you can use online that are very well established to show you how to do this calculation. Phase 4 studies are done on standards of care. So once you have a drug that has approval by the FDA, you then go back and you start asking in routine clinical practice, do we see any substantial toxicity profile? And you start collecting this. So there are a lot of drugs that are approved by the FDA, especially drugs that are approved based on relatively small numbers of patients in relatively small clinical trials, where they continue to collect information about toxicity and about side effects and about all sorts of things like that. And this is called phase 4 studies. This is a post-marketing study. So in terms of review, phase 1 is done to establish safety. Phase 2 is done to establish promising therapeutic targets, and you have to have efficacy. And phase 3 is demonstrated to prove whether the drug you're testing is better than the standard of care or equivalent to the standard of care. And in order to do a quality phase 3 trial, you need to make a power calculation. Once the drug has proven efficacy, you file a new drug application to the FDA. You provide all the data about your toxicity, your animal data, your production data, all of your clinical data, the information on your PK/PD, the appropriateness of the proposed labeling. You put in something called the package insert, which is that thing you get when you go to the drugstore. They give you a drug and it comes with this sheet that's printed in like 6-point font that nobody can read. You guys seen those before, right? If you read through that, it'll tell you all about the toxicities that they observed with the drug early on. It's actually very interesting. I highly recommend getting your magnifying glass and taking a look at them. And that sheet is actually approved by the FDA. They talk about methods of manufacturing and quality control. There's a slightly different process to go through to get a biological license application, which is for monoclonal antibodies and cytokines, which are a little bit different, which are copies of things that are made in people or antibodies that are made, and for non-vaccine immunotherapeutics. The FDA will approve a drug based on clinical benefit. Sometimes they'll do this based on phase 2 data, for specific indications. So, in fact, Taxol was approved for use in advanced ovarian cancer, metastatic breast cancer, and node-positive breast cancer, but not for lung cancer. But we use the drug all the time in lung cancer because phase 2 and phase 3 data showed good efficacy. Determination of efficacy is based on response rates or survival, but can also be based on quality of life. So gemcitabine is actually approved for pancreas cancer, largely based on improvements in quality of life. It only improved survival by about 2 weeks. But patients who got gemcitabine did much better in terms of how they felt. Once a drug is approved by the FDA, a physician can write the drug in any indication, right? As long as the insurance company will pay for it. Insurers will usually reimburse for drugs that are used outside the labeled indication as long as there's good quality phase 2 data demonstrating efficacy. So I very routinely use the drug sorafenib, which is approved for kidney cancer and for liver cancer. This is a very dirty tyrosine kinase inhibitor that hits a variety of different targets, but it also hits FLT3. This drug has been approved by the FDA for many years. It hits FLT3, and so we routinely use it for patients with FLT3 IgG-positive acute myeloid leukemia who don't have access to a clinical trial that uses a FLT3 inhibitor. Okay, so as a physician, I'm allowed to write for that prescription. And then I have to negotiate with the insurance company to say, you should really pay this $5,000 or $10,000 a month to pay for this drug that I'm going to give to my patients because of this very clear data that shows that it's efficacious. Okay? In fact, now that we have pretty good phase 2 data, the NCCN guidelines have included the use of sorafenib in combination with azacitidine in the NCCN guidelines recommendation, and now insurance companies actually have to give approval for it. So when we think about differences in development paradigm, we think about differences in terms of cytotoxic, we think about maximum tolerated dosing, we think about dose escalation, we think about the ways of testing this. This is a genotoxic approach. By contrast, when we have a targeted therapeutic, our approach to drug development is a little bit different. Because we have a target, we have a relatively well-tolerated drug that's side effect profile might be idiosyncratic, right? Nobody knew when they first started giving imatinib that patients were going to have all sorts of swelling or pleural effusions or pancreatitis. Nobody had really realized that. So the side effect profile could actually be somewhat confusing. The phase 1, you identify a biologically effective dose, right? So you want to see a dose in which the drug hits the target all the time, as opposed to a more traditional cytotoxic dose where you want to see cell killing. For targeted therapeutics, we usually know, or we think we know, the mechanism in advance. For cytotoxics, we often just see activity, right? So we see activity, we see cell killing in vitro, now we give the drug. And then maybe sometimes afterwards we figure out the mechanism. So that is sort of a rapid overview of all of these things. Does anybody have any questions? I think for the examination, I usually ask questions regarding, because it's much easier to ask, I usually ask questions regarding the different phases of clinical trial development and what they're intended to test, right? I will probably ask a question about how to decide how many patients to put in a phase 3 trial. I might ask you to list some types of exposure, say infectious exposures, that result in a higher rate of malignancy, right? I think all of those are low-hanging fruit for the exam. Okay? Have a great day.